accusing Churchill of being in bed with the warmongers, who followed the racial theory that only English speakers could decide the fate of the whole world. The speech aroused intense passions on all sides. Major newspapers were mixed in their reactions. The New York Times applauded Churchill's harsh rhetoric, spoken with the force of the prophet proved right before. The Washington Post also found elements to applaud, but criticized Churchill's illogical call for an international police force as overdoing the emphasis on force. The Chicago Tribune agreed with Churchill's analysis of what was occurring in Eastern Europe, but sharply disagreed with his remedy, and pounced upon his defense of British imperialism. He proposes an alliance, half slave and half free, with the British Empire representing slavery. He comes really as a suppliant, begging assistance for that old and evil empire, and frankly expecting to get it on his own terms. Such an alliance would require U.S. acceptance of the enslavement and exploitation of millions of British subjects. The Tribune lectured sternly that the United States should not use its power to maintain British tyranny throughout the world. We cannot become partners in slaveholding. Several senators vigorously denounced Churchill's defense of empire. Maine Republican Owen Brewster proclaimed, "We cannot assume the heritage of colonial policy represented by the British Foreign and Colonial Office. 9/10 of the world is not Anglo-Saxon. We must consider how we are going to gain the confidence of the world that is not Slav or Anglo-Saxon. I fear an alliance with Britain would be the catalyst that would precipitate the world against us. We should orient American policy independently with the Russians." Florida's Claude Pepper observed, "He spoke beautifully for imperialism, but it is always British imperialism. I think his Tory sentiments make him as much opposed to Russia as to a Labour government in his own country. We want Anglo-American cooperation, but not at the exclusion of the rest of the world." Pepper later joined fellow Democrats Harley Kilgore of West Virginia and Glenn Taylor of Idaho in issuing a statement rejecting Churchill's proposal for an old-fashioned power politics military alliance between Great Britain and the United States that would cut the throat of the UNO. Pepper told reporters, "It is shocking to see Mr. Churchill align himself with the old Chamberlain Tories who strengthened the Nazis as part of their anti-Soviet crusade. The people of the world who really want peace must take note of this Tory clamor in Britain and the United States, which is building up war. The new British-American imperialism, which Mr. Churchill proposes and defends, makes us false to the very ideals for which both nations fought." Nor did the public clamor to support Churchill's belligerent call. As one Washington Post reader asserted, "Senator Pepper and his colleagues should be congratulated on the courageous reply to the warmongering speech of Churchill. Who is the President of the United States, Truman or Churchill? Why should Churchill tell us what our policy should be when even the British people repudiated Churchill's policies in the last election? Churchill is a warmonger, and it is time that Senator Pepper told him so. We need a second declaration of independence from British rule." Riding on the train to Missouri with Churchill, Truman had read Churchill's speech in its entirety and heartily approved of its contents. But, in light of the outcry against Churchill's pugnacity, he denied having advanced knowledge of what Churchill would say. Truman's bold-faced lies were quickly exposed by journalists. Led by members of the Roosevelt family, New Deal progressives condemned Churchill and beseeched Truman to change course before it was too late. Speaking publicly, Eleanor Roosevelt deplored Churchill's inflammatory remarks. James Roosevelt, Franklin and Eleanor's oldest son, did likewise at a meeting of the Independent Citizens Committee of the Arts, Sciences, and Professions. He declared, "Let us make clear to all the world that the Right Honorable Winston Churchill, now a guest in our country, speaks only for himself when he attacks world peace. When he proposes once again that mankind divide itself into two camps. Too often in the past his cronies, both here and abroad, have been outright reactionaries. It is up to us, and to every peace-loving man and woman in the world, to stand up now and repudiate the word, the schemes, and the political allies of the Honorable Winston Churchill. Roosevelt knew what Truman could do if he wanted to ease tensions. I would like to see the Secretary of Commerce, Henry Wallace, fly to Russia. Because of his reputation for fairness and integrity, Roosevelt explained, a personal mission from him to Stalin could do more for peace and understanding than any number of sharply worded notes or communiques. James Roosevelt had been introduced by Harold Ickes, Roosevelt's former long-standing Secretary of the Interior, who, as a stalwart New Deal progressive, had consistently been a thorn in Truman's side. Truman had finally rid himself of Ickes the previous month, after earlier denigrating him in front of reporters as shit-ass Ickes. Ickes' resignation came over his opposition to Truman's nominating California oil millionaire Edwin Pauley, to whose nefarious activities Truman owed his office, as Assistant Secretary of the Navy. But Ickes stood in the way, accusing Pauley of lying when he testified that he had not lobbied against the government suit to assert federal title to the oil along the nation's coasts. Ickes alleged that Pauley had offered the rawest proposition ever made to me. Oil men would contribute $300,000 to the Democratic Party in 1944 if the government dropped the Tideland suit that Ickes had brought. Ickes reported that at a special cabinet meeting the previous week, Truman had implored him to be as gentle as you can with Ed Pauley, and that party chairman Robert Hannigan had been moving heaven and earth to get Pauley confirmed. Ickes chose integrity over gentleness. He lashed out, "I don't care to stay in an administration where I am expected to commit perjury for the sake of the party." He released his acerbic exchange of letters with Truman over the resignation. He warned that unless the administration changed its unsavory ways, it would bring about a scandal reminiscent of Teapot Dome. "The Department of the Interior," he reminded Truman, "must always be on guard against any association of money with politics." Ickes also told reporters that no oil man should be allowed to hold a government office that dealt with oil policy. The Los Angeles Times headlined its front page article, "Ickes Blow-Up Rocks Capital Like Atom Bomb," describing what reporter Bill Henry called the biggest press conference in the history of Washington. In introducing James Roosevelt, Ickes offered some sage advice to his former boss on dealing with the Soviets. "The people want President Truman to stand up aggressively for the foreign policies of President Roosevelt. They do not feel comfortable with the sniping at Russia, which is being indulged in. They know that without Russia, we would still be fighting the war. They cannot envision a peaceful future without an understanding with Russia." The following month, on the first anniversary of Roosevelt's death, Wallace spoke in New York City Hall, repudiating Churchill and proposing a different vision of competition between the two nations. "The only kind of competition we want with the Soviets is to demonstrate that we can raise our standard of living faster during the next 20 years than Russia. We shall compete with Russia in serving the spiritual and physical needs of the common man. The only way to defeat communism in the world is to do a better and smoother job of maximum production and optimum distribution. Let's make it a clean race, a determined race, but above all a peaceful race in the service of humanity. Russia can't ride roughshod over Eastern Europe and get away with it, any more than we can do the same in Latin America, or England in India and Africa. The source of all our mistakes is fear. Russia fears Anglo-Saxon encirclement. We fear communist penetration. If these fears continue, the day will come when our sons and grandsons will pay for these fears with rivers of blood. Out of fear, great nations have been acting like cornered beasts, thinking only of survival. A month ago, Mr. Churchill came out for the Anglo-Saxon century. 4 years ago, I repudiated the American century. Today I repudiate the Anglo-Saxon century with even greater vigor. The common people of the world will not tolerate a recrudescence of imperialism, even under enlightened Anglo-Saxon atomic bomb auspices. The destiny of the English-speaking people is to serve the world, not dominate it. Following Churchill's speech, U.S.-Soviet relations deteriorated rapidly. At the United Nations, the United States pressed for a confrontation over Iran, despite the Soviet Union's agreement to withdraw its troops. When Soviet troops stayed beyond the March 2nd deadline for their removal, Truman threatened war. He wrote, "If the Russians were to control Iran's oil, either directly or indirectly, the raw material balance of the world would undergo serious damage, and it would be a serious loss for the economy of the Western world." Forrestal afterward noted that, "Whoever sits on the valve of Middle East oil may control the destiny of Europe." Truman decided to send a clear message that the United States, not the Soviet Union, would sit on that valve. Former Columbia President Nicholas Murray Butler, the 1931 Nobel Peace Prize winner and president of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, made it clear that the issue involved was oil, not democracy. "Iran is wholly a question of oil," he explained. "Large commitments have been proposed and made to Great Britain. A way ought to be found for Russia to have a share of the oil, without carrying on a political military disturbance." Some found that suggestion quite plausible. In an editorial on the crisis, the Washington Post suggested that Russia may have legitimate claims to make on Iran. On the oil situation, for instance, we have repeatedly argued that a joint plan for the exploitation of the oil resources of the Middle East is definitely in order. Claude Pepper got a closer look at the unfolding crisis in his tour of the Middle East, which included an interview with Stalin. After returning to the United States, Pepper addressed the Senate, exonerating the Soviet Union and condemning British imperial overreach. "It comes with ill grace from a certain world power, whose people are stationed in every nation from Egypt to Singapore, to make a world conflagration out of the movement of a few troops a few miles into some neighboring territory, to resist an oil monopoly which they enjoy. If American foreign policy is made the scapegoat for such imperialism, it is more stupid than I thought it possible for it to be." The Washington Post reported that after Pepper finished, several senators and House members walked over to shake his hand. The public was not enthusiastic about confronting the Soviet Union over Iranian oil. The Washington Post carried a particularly illuminating letter, identifying the stakes in Iran and disavowing military action. "I do not believe that the fate of the oil deposits of Iran justifies war with Russia. If this oil were located in North or South America, the United States would both protect these oil deposits for our use in any future war and guarantee that no other strong power could seize these oil fields. If the Iranian oil occupied a geographic position near any of the British dominions, as it does next to the Soviet states, I believe Great Britain would secure or protect this oil. The support of Iranian freedom has never before been suggested as justifying an overseas war for Americans. Iranian freedom, as we understand freedom, has never existed, so those who suggest war in support of such freedom are without a real cause. I am firmly convinced that the vast majority of Americans do not want to fight Russia for any cause that has yet developed. I also believe that a majority of Americans hope and think that left alone with her own borders reasonably secure, that Russia will work to help support the peace of the world and to develop her own great natural resources for generations to come." Pressured by the United States and Great Britain, Soviet forces withdrew from Iran. Truman later told Senator Henry "Scoop" Jackson that he had summoned Soviet Ambassador Andrei Gromyko to the White House and informed him that if Soviet troops weren't out in 48 hours, "we're going to drop it on you." They were out, he claimed, in 24 hours. Although the real story behind Soviet withdrawal is much more complicated, Truman drew the lesson that when confronted with superior force, the Soviets would back down. The United States decided to press its advantage. In May, it halted reparation shipments from Western Germany that the Soviets desperately needed. In July, it decided to keep troops in South Korea and the following month to maintain a naval presence in the Eastern Mediterranean. While Truman was making atomic threats, the public quaked at the prospect of atomic war. In early 1946, Ladies' Home Journal instructed readers, "Over and above all else you do, the thought you should wake up to, go to sleep with, and carry with you all day is prevention of nuclear war." Henry Wallace agreed and pushed Truman to pursue international control of atomic weapons more aggressively. In January 1946, Truman appointed Acheson, who had voiced similar concerns, to head a committee to tackle the problem. Acheson named Tennessee Valley Authority, TVA Administrator, David Lilienthal, to chair a board of scientific advisors. Acheson confided to Lilienthal that Truman and Burns had neither the facts nor an understanding of what was involved in the atomic energy issue, the most serious cloud hanging over the world. Commitments had been made, and with Burns then in London, new ones were being made, without a knowledge of what the hell it is all about, literally. Acheson bemoaned the fact that the War Department, and really one man in the War Department, General Groves, has, by the power of veto on the ground of military security, really been determining and almost running foreign policy. The resulting Acheson-Lilienthal report, which the hard-headed Acheson described as a brilliant and profound document, was largely the work of Oppenheimer. Under the plan, an international atomic development authority would oversee the mining, refining, and utilization of all the world's atomic raw materials, denaturing all fissionable material and making it available for peaceful uses. National activity in these dangerous areas would be outlawed. The plan intentionally minimized the need for on-site inspections to increase the chances that the Soviet Union would accept it. Hopes for an international agreement were dashed when Truman and Burns appointed Burns's fellow South Carolinian, 75-year-old financier Bernard Baruch, to present the plan to the United Nations. Paying off another old political debt, Truman empowered him to revise it as he saw fit. Baruch had bankrolled Truman when he trailed in his 1940 Senate re-election bid and desperately needed funds. All involved, including Acheson, Lilienthal, and Oppenheimer, were furious, knowing that Baruch, an outspoken anti-communist who viewed the bomb as the United States' winning weapon, would reformulate the plan so that the Soviets would reject it out of hand. Lilienthal wrote in his journal, "When I read this news last night, I was quite sick. We need a man who is young, vigorous, not vain, and who the Russians would feel isn't out simply to put them in a hole, not really caring about international cooperation. Baruch has none of these qualifications." Baruch's choice of fellow businessmen as advisors further infuriated those who had labored so hard to come up with a plan that would work. He decided not to include scientists because, he later explained, "I concluded that I would drop the scientists because, as I told them, I knew all I wanted to know. It went boom and it killed millions of people." Vannevar Bush, who had served on the Acheson-Lilienthal committee, dismissed Baruch's advisors as Wall Streeters. He let Baruch know that he considered him and the rest of the crew completely unqualified for the job. Baruch announced that he would turn to Groves and the industrialists for advice on technical matters. Facing widespread criticism, Baruch finally relented and asked Oppenheimer to come on board as chief scientific advisor. "Don't let those associates of mine worry you," he told the physicist. "Hancock is pretty right, but, winking, I'll watch him. Searles is smart as a whip, but he sees reds under every bed." He said they would have to begin preparing the American people for a refusal by Russia. Oppenheimer declined the invitation. Baruch proceeded to amend the original proposal, larding it with inspections and other provisions that the Soviets would be certain to reject. Not only did Acheson and Lilienthal try to convince him to remove those provisions, Truman and Burns did too. Baruch remained adamant, threatening to resign if his plan was not adopted. And Truman, in a colossal failure of presidential leadership, backed down. On the eve of Baruch submitting the plan to the United Nations on June 14th, Burns admitted to Acheson that appointing Baruch was the worst mistake I have ever made. Even Truman later privately admitted that appointing Baruch was the worst blunder I ever made. Soviet leaders waited 10 days before lashing out at the U.S. proposal. Pravda charged that the Baruch plan was a product of atomic diplomacy and reflects the obvious tendency toward world domination. The plan made it clear that the United States intends to consolidate its monopoly on the production of atomic weapons. Pravda pointed out that the U.S. government had contracted production of bombs to private monopolistic firms, such as E.I. DuPont de Nemours, whose entire pre-war outlook was connected by 1,000 threads to the German IG Farben industry. The Soviets submitted a counterplan of their own, which would ban production, stockpiling, and the use of atomic weapons. Existing stockpiles would be destroyed within 3 months. The U.S. decision to proceed with its July 1st atomic bomb test in the Bikini Atoll in the Marshall Islands sent the Soviets another chilling message about U.S. intentions. The General Assembly of the Universalist Church denounced the tests as being offensive to the very purpose of the Christian spirit. Ickes described the Bikini tests as diplomacy by intimidation and noted that if it were the Soviets carrying them out, Americans would find cause for deep concern about the future peace of the world. Raymond Graham Swing told his ABC radio listeners that many Americans, including atomic scientists and members of Congress, had protested the decision. On the one hand, was striving to rid the world of a weapon which may set back civilization for centuries. On the other hand, we're training ourselves in the use of this very weapon. So we strive to save civilization, and we learn how to wreck it, all on the same weekend. The Soviets predictably responded in similar fashion. Pravda's Boris Itzhakov wondered why the Americans would go to such lengths to improve their bombs if they were serious about disarmament. There was indeed a madness to the unfolding nuclear arms race that no one expressed better than Lewis Mumford when he first learned that the test was to occur. In an article in Norman Cousins's Saturday Review titled, "Gentlemen, You Are Mad," Mumford wrote, "We in America are living among madmen. Madmen govern our affairs in the name of order and security. The chief madmen claim the titles of general, admiral, senator, scientist, administrator, secretary of state, even president. And the fatal symptom of their madness is this. They have been carrying through a series of acts which will lead eventually to the destruction of mankind, under the solemn conviction that they are normal, responsible people, living sane lives, and working for reasonable ends. Soberly, day after day, the madmen continue to go through the undeviating motions of madness, motions so stereotyped, so commonplace, that they seem the normal motions of normal men, not the mass compulsions of people bent on total death. Without a public mandate of any kind, the madmen have taken it upon themselves to lead us by gradual stages to that final act of madness, which will corrupt the face of the earth and blot out the nations of men, possibly put an end to all life on the planet itself." Henry Wallace tried to stop the madness. In July 1946, he wrote a long memo to Truman, repudiating the growing feeling that another war is coming, and the only way that we can head it off is to arm ourselves to the teeth. All of past history indicates that an armament race does not lead to peace, but to war. He saw the coming months as very possibly the crucial period which will decide whether the civilized world will go down in destruction after the 5 or 10 years needed for several nations to arm themselves with atomic bombs. He urged Truman to consider how Americans' actions since VJ Day appear to other nations, pointing to $13 billion for the War and Navy departments, the bikini tests of the atomic bomb and continued production of bombs, the plan to arm Latin America with our weapons, production of B-29s, and planned production of B-36s, and the effort to secure air bases spread over half the globe, from which the other half of the globe can be bombed. This makes it appear either, one, that we are preparing ourselves to win the war which we regard as inevitable, or two, that we are trying to build up a predominance of force to intimidate the rest of mankind. How would it look to us if Russia had the atomic bomb and we did not? If Russia had 10,000-mile bombers and air bases within 1,000 miles of our coastlines and we did not? Wallace called for sharply cutting defense spending, because maintaining peace by a predominance of forces is no longer possible. In 1938, the United States spent less than $1 billion on national defense. Now, he calculated, the War and Navy departments, war liquidation, and interest on public debt and veterans' benefits, representing the cost of past wars, consumed $28 billion, or 80% of the current $36 billion budget. Wallace reiterated scientists' warnings that atomic warfare is cheap, and even having 10 times as many bombs as one's enemy gives no decisive advantage. And most important, the very fact that several nations have atomic bombs will inevitably result in a neurotic, fear-ridden, itching-trigger psychology. In a world armed with atomic weapons, some incident will lead to the use of those weapons. He forcefully dismissed those advocating a preventive war whose scheme is not only immoral but stupid. The only solution, he concluded, consists of mutual trust and confidence among nations, atomic disarmament, and an effective system of enforcing that disarmament. Wallace's peace offensive was aided by 2 significant publications that summer. In late August, The New Yorker devoted an entire issue to John Hersey's Hiroshima that did more to humanize the victims of the atomic bombings than any other contemporary English-language publication. In September, Look magazine began publishing a 4-part series by Elliot Roosevelt that detailed how his father's and Stalin's plans for post-war peace and collaboration were derailed by Truman and Churchill. Truman would later dismiss Roosevelt's son as the product of a piss erection. Wallace understood the urgency of the situation. He looked forward to a major address on September 12th in New York's Madison Square Garden. Before delivering the speech, Wallace went over it with Truman, who repeatedly expressed his agreement. Truman told reporters beforehand that he had read it and concurred entirely with its sentiments. In New York, with 20,000 in attendance, Wallace sat on stage with Paul Robeson, as Claude Pepper told the crowd, "With conservative Democrats and reactionary Republicans making our foreign policy as they are today, it is all we can do to keep foolish people from having us pull a Hitler blitzkrieg and drop our atomic bombs on the Russian people." When Wallace's turn came, he delivered a powerful plea for peace. "Tonight I want to talk about peace and how to get peace. Never have the common people of all lands so longed for peace, yet never have they feared war so much. We cannot rest in the assurance that we invented the atom bomb. He who trusts in the atom bomb will sooner or later perish by the atom bomb. The British imperialistic policy in the Near East alone, combined with Russian retaliation, would lead the United States straight to war. We are reckoning with a force which cannot be handled successfully by a get tough with Russia policy. This does not mean appeasement. We want to be met halfway. And I believe that we can get cooperation once Russia understands that our primary objective is neither saving the British Empire nor purchasing oil in the Near East with the lives of American soldiers. We cannot allow national oil rivalries to force us into war. We have no more business in the political affairs of Eastern Europe than Russia has in the political affairs of Latin America, Western Europe, and the United States. We may not like what Russia does in Eastern Europe. Her type of land reform, industrial expropriation, and suppression of basic liberties offends the great majority of the people of the United States. But at the same time, we have to recognize that the Balkans are closer to Russia than to us, and that Russia cannot permit either England or the United States to dominate the politics of that area. Russian ideas of social economic justice are going to govern nearly a third of the world. Our ideas of free enterprise democracy will govern much of the rest. The two ideas will endeavor to prove which can deliver the most satisfaction to the common man in their respective areas of political dominance. Under friendly, peaceful competition, the Russian world and the American world will gradually become more alike. The Russians will be forced to grant more and more of the personal freedoms, and we shall become more and more absorbed with the problems of social economic justice. Russia must be convinced that we are not planning for war against her, and we must be certain that Russia is not carrying on territorial expansion or world domination. The United Nations should have control of the strategically located air bases with which the United States and Britain have encircled the world. And not only should individual nations be prohibited from manufacturing atomic bombs, guided missiles, and military aircraft for bombing purposes, but no nation should be allowed to spend on its military establishment more than perhaps 15% of its budget. We who look on this war with Russia talk as criminal foolishness must carry our message direct to the people, even though we may be called communists because we dare to speak out. The speech was absolutely incendiary. Republican Senator Robert Taft accused Truman of betraying Burns, who was irate over being so publicly repudiated. The New York Times' James Reston wrote that Truman was the only person in Washington who saw no difference between what Wallace advocated and what Truman and Burns had been proposing. The State Department let it be known that this was more embarrassing to Burns than if someone had yanked off his pants in the middle of the Paris conference. British officials were furious. Experts in the British Foreign Office said, "There is no such thing as the government of the United States," and the London press sneered that American foreign policy is still in the hillbilly stage. Many rallied to Wallace's defense. Eleanor Roosevelt approved Wallace's remarks. "He tried to make clear that we neither approved of British imperialism nor of Soviet aggression. He stated that we wanted to be friendly with Russia, that we wanted to meet her halfway, but that she also had to meet us halfway." Having become an object of international derision, Truman attempted to tell reporters that he meant only to defend Wallace's right to express his opinions, not the content of his speech. He later denied that he had read and approved the entire speech in advance. In the midst of the controversy, someone leaked Wallace's July 23rd memo to Truman, in which he identified the fatal defect in the Baruch plan. Several Soviet newspapers published it in its entirety. "That defect is the scheme of arriving at international agreements by easy stages, of requiring other nations to enter into binding commitments not to conduct research into the military uses of atomic energy, and to disclose their uranium and thorium resources, while the United States retains the right to withhold its technical knowledge of atomic energy until the international control and inspection system is working to our satisfaction." Is it any wonder that the Russians did not show any great enthusiasm for our plan? I think we would react as the Russians appear to have done. We would have put up counterproposal for the record, but our real effort would go into trying to make a bomb so that our bargaining position would be equalized. Realistically, Russia has two cards which she can use in negotiating with us. One, our lack of information on the state of her scientific and technical progress on atomic energy, and two, our ignorance of her uranium and thorium resources. These cards are nothing like as powerful as our cards: a stockpile of bombs, manufacturing plants in actual production, B-29s and B-36s, and our bases covering half the globe. Yet we are in effect asking her to reveal her only two cards immediately, telling her that after we have seen her cards, we will decide whether we want to continue to play the game. Truman insisted that Wallace stop talking about foreign policy while the post-war conference of the Council of Foreign Ministers was taking place. Burns had cabled Truman from Paris to complain that Wallace's speech and memo had thrown the meeting into complete disarray. Burns and Baruch were both threatening to resign. Truman feared that Forrestal and Secretary of War Robert Patterson would do likewise. He decided to fire Wallace and wrote a scathing letter demanding his resignation. Wallace immediately phoned the president to say that the letter would not reflect well on Truman if it got out. Truman immediately sent someone over to pick it up. No copy remains. Only Truman's diary entry that night gives us some indication of what he might have written. He described Wallace as a pacifist 100%. He wants us to disband our armed forces, give Russia our atomic secrets, and trust a bunch of adventurers in the Kremlin Politburo. I do not understand a dreamer like that. The German-American Bund under Fritz Kuhn was not half so dangerous. The Reds, phonies, and parlor pinks seem to be banded together and are becoming a national danger. I am afraid they are a sabotage front for Uncle Joe Stalin. With Wallace's departure, the last chance to avert the Cold War and nuclear arms race disappeared. That night, September 20th, 1946, Wallace told a national radio audience, "Winning the peace is more important than high office. It is more important than any consideration of party politics. The success or failure of our foreign policy will mean the difference between life and death for our children and our grandchildren. It will mean the difference between the life and death of our civilization. It may mean the difference between the existence and the extinction of man and of the world. It is therefore of supreme importance, and we should every one of us regard it as a holy duty to join the fight for winning the peace. I wish to make it clear again that I am against all types of imperialism and aggression, whether they are of Russian, British, or American origin. The success of any policy rests ultimately upon the confidence and the will of the people. There can be no basis for such success unless the people know and understand the issues, unless they are given all the facts, and unless they seize the opportunity to take part in the framing of foreign policy through full and open debate. In this debate, we must respect the rights and interests of other peoples, just as we expect them to respect ours. How we resolve this debate, as I said in my New York speech, will determine not whether we live in one world, but whether we live at all. I intend to carry on the fight for peace." Support for Wallace had poured in throughout the controversy. Albert Einstein wrote, "I cannot refrain from expressing to you my high and unconditional admiration for your letter to the President of July 23rd. There is a deep understanding concerning the factual and psychological situation and a far-reaching perception of present American foreign policy. Your courageous intervention deserves the gratitude of all of us who observe the present attitude of our government with grave concern." With Wallace gone, the United States plunged headlong into Cold War, both at home and abroad. On September 24th, the long-awaited report from White House counsel Clark Clifford and his assistant George Elsie arrived. The comprehensive review of Soviet actions, intentions, and capabilities was intended to show that the Soviets had regularly violated their agreements. It painted a dire picture of Soviet efforts to weaken the position and to destroy the prestige of the United States in Europe, Asia, and South America, so they could rule the world, while sowing discord in the United States through the Communist Party. The United States needed to respond by beefing up its atomic arsenal, expanding its network of overseas bases, strengthening its military capabilities, and mobilizing its resources to assist all democracies which are in any way menaced or endangered by the USSR. They failed, however, to document Soviet perfidy in regard to treaty obligations, admitting that it is difficult to adduce direct evidence of literal violations. In a penetrating critique of the report's distortions, historian Melvin Leffler wrote, Clifford and Elsie ignored actions that might have injected hues of gray into their black-and-white characterization of Soviet foreign policy, such as all the instances where the Soviets had honored or exceeded their agreements, withdrawn their troops, allowed free elections, and discouraged insurrectionary activity. Double standards and self-deception repeatedly crept into the Clifford-Elsie report, he noted, adding, Truman's advisors did not ask how America's own questionable record of compliance affected Soviet behavior. They did not acknowledge that General Lucius Clay and other War Department officials consistently identified France, not Russia, as the principal source of U.S. problems in Germany. They suspected that any Soviet interest in German unification masked the Kremlin's quest to gain leverage over all of Germany, but conveniently dismissed the American desire to dilute Soviet influence in the East and to orient all of Germany to the West. Likewise, Clifford and Elsie pointed to the retention of Russian troops in Iran as irrefutable proof of the Soviet desire to dominate Iran and gain control of Middle Eastern oil. They did not say, and may not have known, that at the very time they were writing their report, State Department officials and military planners were contending that the U.S. troops must remain beyond the stipulated deadlines for their withdrawal in Iceland, the Azores, Panama, the Galapagos, and other locations in order to augment American bargaining leverage for post-war base and military transit rights. Leffler also accused them of presenting a totally misleading rendition of Soviet capabilities. Clifford later admitted that it was the kind of black-and-white analysis that Truman liked. Clifford and Elsie ruled out further efforts to negotiate with the Soviets. The language of military power, they wrote, is the only language the Soviets understand. Hence, they warned ominously, the United States must be prepared to wage atomic and biological warfare against the Soviet Union. Truman ordered Clifford to round up all 10 copies of the report and lock them up. If this got out, he snapped, it would blow the roof off the White House. It would blow the roof off the Kremlin. It would also prove that Wallace, whom Truman had fired 4 days earlier, had been correct in all his warnings about the hard-line, confrontational direction of U.S. policy. In his response to Clifford and Elsie's questions, Admiral Leahy provided Truman and Clifford with copies of the will of Tsar Peter the Great, in which he urged the Russians to conquer large parts of Asia and Europe and maintain a constant war footing. No one questioned the veracity of this notorious 18th-century forgery. Truman cited it on several occasions, drawing continuities between Tsarist policies and those of the present Stalinist regime. While the Soviets were imposing friendly left-wing governments in their sphere, the British were imposing right-wing governments in theirs. In Greece, the British army toppled the popular leftist National Liberation Front and restored the monarchy and the right-wing dictatorship. Jailing of critics and other repressive measures soon sparked a communist-led uprising. The Yugoslavs provided support, but the Soviets did not, as Stalin abided by his wartime agreement with Churchill that placed Greece within the British sphere of influence. Following the severe winter of 1946 to 1947, financially strapped Great Britain asked the United States to take the lead in defeating the Greek insurgents and modernizing the Turkish army. One State Department official later commented, Great Britain had within the hour handed the job of world leadership to the United States. But the war-weary public and the Republican-controlled Congress, which was intent upon reducing taxes and cutting back U.S. international commitments, stood in Truman's way. The Republicans had trounced the Democrats in the November 1946 congressional elections, employing the kind of red-baiting tactics that would become so familiar over the next decade. The Republican National Committee chairman declared the election a choice between communism and republicanism, and charged that alien-minded radicals had seized control of the Democratic Party. Congress was reluctant to foot the bill for Truman's costly Greek and Turkish initiatives. Soviet military probes in the Mediterranean had largely ceased, and tensions between the United States and the Soviet Union had again abated. Senator Arthur Vandenberg told Truman that he would have to scare the hell out of the country if he hoped to win approval for a global anti-communist campaign that would change foreign policy from top to bottom. Dean Acheson took the lead in crafting the administration's message, framing it as a struggle between freedom and totalitarianism. Only a few months earlier, he had complained about supporting the reactionary regime in Greece, but the Turkish crisis had convinced him otherwise. The son of a clergyman, Acheson believed that life was a pilgrimage from birth to death through a battleground between good and evil. He told a group of congressional leaders, "Like apples in a barrel infected by one rotten one, the corruption of Greece would infect Iran, and then all to the east. It would also carry infection to Africa through Asia Minor and Egypt, and to Europe through Italy and France, already threatened by the strongest domestic communist parties in Western Europe." He called it an Armageddon. George Kennan, who was head of the State Department policy planning staff, and others, including George C. Marshall, whom Truman had picked to replace Burns as Secretary of State, George Elsey, and Soviet expert Chip Bohlen, found this far-fetched. Truman sided with Acheson against those who advised him to tone down the rhetoric. Addressing both houses of Congress, Truman appealed for $400 million to finance efforts in Greece and Turkey, and declared that the United States must support free peoples who are resisting subjugation by armed minorities or outside pressure, thence to be known as the Truman Doctrine. After a heated debate, Congress fell into line. Many members, however, were troubled by Truman's call to arms and support for blatantly undemocratic and unpopular governments. Bernard Baruch described the speech as tantamount to a declaration of ideological or religious war. Marshall criticized Truman's exaggerations. Walter Lippmann was so upset with the Truman Doctrine's overblown rhetoric and apparently open-ended commitment to intervention that he and Acheson almost came to blows at a Washington dinner party. Some, including Kennan, rejected Truman's justification for aiding Turkey, which faced no overt Soviet threat, and feared that Stalin would respond the way Truman would if the Soviets sent military aid to Mexico. Once again, Henry Wallace led the opposition. The day after Truman's speech, he took to the airwaves on the NBC radio network to decry the utter nonsense of describing the Turkish or Greek governments as democratic, and accused Truman of betraying Roosevelt's vision for world peace. "When President Truman proclaims the worldwide conflict between East and West," he warned, "he is telling the Soviet leaders that we are preparing for eventual war." People the world over were feeling hungry and insecure and demanding change. Trying to thwart that change was not only futile, it was counterproductive. "Once America stands for opposition to change," he prophesied, "we are lost. America will become the most hated nation in the world." Military aid was not the answer. "Truman's policy," he predicted, "will spread communism in Europe and Asia. When Truman offers unconditional aid to King George of Greece, he is acting as the best salesman communism ever had." The Soviets responded angrily. Pravda accused the United States of imperialist expansion under the guise of charity and trying to extend the Monroe Doctrine to the old world. Howard K. Smith, who was in Moscow covering the conference of the Council of Foreign Ministers for CBS, wrote that Truman's message had changed the atmosphere in Moscow and throughout Eastern Europe. In late May, the Soviets sponsored a communist coup overthrowing the democratically elected government in Hungary. The New York Times opined, "The coup in Hungary is Russia's answer to our action in Greece and Turkey." The Greek civil war grew bloodier, and U.S. personnel began arriving in the war zone in June 1947. They used Greece to test tactics, some new and some old, that would later be employed in Vietnam, such as the destruction of unions, torture, napalming villages, forced mass deportations to concentration camps without trial or charges, mass imprisonment of wives and children of subversives, mass executions ordered by military court-martials, and censorship of the press. Greece was thus kept in the hands of monarchists and wealthy businessmen, many of them Nazi collaborators. The victims were primarily the workers and peasants who'd resisted the Nazis. Fighting raged on for a couple more years. Historian George Herring described it as an especially savage conflict, with atrocities on both sides in which even children became pawns. In addition to sending a large contingent of advisors, the United States armed the right-wing Greek monarchy to the teeth. The Soviet Union temporarily assisted the left-wing forces, but then cut off aid. In February 1948, Stalin ordered Yugoslavia's Marshal Josip Broz Tito to stop supporting the guerrilla movement in Greece, precipitating an open rift with his closest ally. When the Yugoslavs pushed back, Stalin thundered, "They have no prospect of success at all. What do you think, that Great Britain and the United States the most powerful nation in the world, will permit you to break their line of communication in the Mediterranean Sea? Nonsense. And we have no navy. The uprising in Greece must be stopped and as quickly as possible." When Tito refused to go along with the Soviet demands, the Cominform expelled Yugoslavia. The State Department reported, "For the first time in history, we may now have within the international community a communist state independent of Moscow." A new factor of fundamental and profound significance has been introduced into the world communist movement by the demonstration that the Kremlin can be successfully defied by one of its own minions. Despite providing covert support for Tito, the United States never adjusted its rhetoric to reflect the fact that international communism was not as monolithic as once believed. Churchill later told an American journalist, "Stalin never broke his word to me. We agreed on the Balkans. I said he could have Romania and Bulgaria, and he said we could have Greece. He signed a slip of paper and he never broke his word. We saved Greece that way." Stalin's halting of support for the uprising spelled doom for the rebels, and Truman heralded the United States' victory. The Greek people weren't so sure. More than 100,000 people died and 800,000 became refugees. The Greek action also had other troubling implications. Though it was a largely homegrown insurgency, Truman treated it as part of a Soviet plan for world domination, setting the stage for U.S. intervention to support right-wing governments in the name of anti-communism. The United States substituted force for diplomacy, embracing unilateralism instead of the United Nations, and repression instead of treating the socio-economic causes of popular discontent. Historian Arnold Offner concluded, "The legacy of this action was that for about three decades, successive Greek governments used the state apparatus, decrees, the police, the military, and a central service of information modeled on the CIA, to systematically persecute their former enemies and deny them their basic rights and livelihood." Marshall adopted a more positive approach to the crisis in Europe. He invited European countries to come up with a plan for economic recovery and development, which the United States would finance. 17 European countries requested $27 billion. The United States eventually spent $13 billion between 1948 and 1952. Great Britain, France, and Germany were the largest recipients, adding to the Soviet fears that the United States was recklessly restoring German power and creating a Western bloc. The Soviet Union and Eastern Europe were invited to participate, but were offered terms that U.S. policymakers knew Stalin would reject. The Soviets were coming to realize that their earlier expectations, that Western unity would run aground on the shoals of imperialist rivalry, were mistaken. Truman described his new doctrine and the Marshall Plan as two halves of the same walnut. Abandoning all hope for continued collaboration with the West, the Soviets offered Eastern Europe its own Molotov plan. They also cracked down with renewed intensity. The last remaining non-communists were soon forced out of government in Bulgaria. Early the following year, the Red Army helped overthrow the Czech government, putting an end to Czech democracy. George Kennan provided the theoretical rationale for the new U.S. policy. His article titled, "The Sources of Soviet Conduct," appeared in the July issue of Foreign Affairs, under the pseudonym X. a Soviet expert who had served in Moscow in the 1930s and 1940s, Kennan emphasized the Soviet Union's global appetites and laid out a plan to contain Soviet expansion with the goal of breaking up Soviet power and maintaining U.S. hegemony. The previous October, he had taken a more nuanced stance, writing, "I think it is a mistake to say that the Soviet leaders wish to establish a communist form of government in the ring of states surrounding the Soviet Union on the west and south. What they do wish to do is to establish in those states governments amenable to their own influence and authority. The main thing is that these governments should follow Moscow's leadership. In certain countries which are already extensively under Soviet influence, as for example Poland, there has been as yet no effort to establish what we might call a communist form of government." The distinction between the two interpretations of Soviet post-war intentions is crucial. Not only did the Soviet Union not have a blueprint for post-war Sovietization of Eastern Europe, it hoped to maintain friendly and collaborative relations with its wartime allies. The last thing it wanted was confrontation with the West. As Russian scholars Vladislav Zubok and Konstantin Pleshakov explain, there was no master plan in the Kremlin, and Stalin's ambitions had always been severely limited by the terrible devastation of the USSR during World War II and the existence of the American atomic monopoly. Unfortunately, Kennan's Foreign Affairs article offered a monochromatic analysis of a Soviet Union bent on conquest. Kennan would long regret that his words were interpreted as support for the kind of militarized response to the Soviet Union that he later abhorred. In looking back, he was appalled by even the more measured message in his telegram, which struck him as if it had been written by the daughters of the American Revolution during an anti-communist tirade. Journalist Walter Lippmann criticized Kennan for resorting to military rather than peaceful settlements, and for the global sweep of his containment policy, which failed to differentiate between vital interests and peripheral ones. He feared that the policy would mean unending intervention in all the countries that are supposed to contain the Soviet Union, and it would undermine the Constitution by vesting too much power in the president as commander-in-chief. While Truman scared the hell out of the American people about communists abroad, the Republicans did the same thing regarding communists at home. Truman decided to steal the Republicans' thunder. Just 9 days after delivering his call for an international crusade against communism, he unveiled an elaborate program to root out subversives working for the federal government, even though, as White House aide Clark Clifford later admitted, the president didn't attach fundamental importance to the so-called communist scare. He thought it was a lot of baloney. But political pressures were such that he had to recognize it. We did not believe there was a real problem. A problem was being manufactured. There was a certain element of hysteria. Truman mandated loyalty checks on all government employees. Those accused could neither confront their accusers nor ascertain the basis of the accusations. Having the wrong views on religion, sexual behavior, foreign policy, or race could brand one as disloyal. An Interior Department Loyalty Board chairman observed, "Of course the fact that a person believes in racial equality doesn't prove that he's a communist, but it certainly makes you look twice, doesn't it?" The FBI conducted field investigations of suspect employees. Even Truman feared that under J. Edgar Hoover, the FBI could become an American Gestapo. Clifford believed that Hoover was very close to being an American fascist. The government organized large meetings at which employees sang "God Bless America" and took freedom pledges. Loyalty boards fired approximately 300 government employees outright and forced 10 times that number to resign between 1947 and 1951, thereby institutionalizing guilt by association and encouraging a stultifying conformity in which much of the nation equated dissent with disloyalty. In October 1947, the House Un-American Activities Committee, HUAC, held public hearings on communist influence in Hollywood. The committee called 11 unfriendly witnesses, including some of Hollywood's most prominent writers and directors. Invoking the First Amendment, 10 refused to answer questions about whether they were members of the Communist Party, which was perfectly legal, and were cited for contempt of Congress. The 11th, playwright Bertolt Brecht, denied being a communist and escaped to East Germany. Brecht had earlier moved to Hollywood to escape from the Nazis. Rather than stand up for their employees, Hollywood studio executives denounced the Hollywood 10 and pledged not to hire anyone with suspect affiliations. Among the friendly witnesses who testified that the communist menace in Hollywood was real was Screen Actors Guild president Ronald Reagan. Robert Taylor, Gary Cooper, and Walt Disney agreed. Far greater numbers of Hollywood celebrities publicly denounced the congressional witch hunts, including Humphrey Bogart, Gregory Peck, Gene Kelly, William Wyler, Lucille Ball, Frank Sinatra, Burt Lancaster, Edward G. Robinson, Lauren Bacall, Orson Welles, Katharine Hepburn, Pete Seeger, Henry Fonda, Ethel Barrymore, Benny Goodman, and Groucho Marx. Despite those efforts, all 10 were convicted of contempt the following year and sentenced to prison. In July 1947, following 5 months of hearings and heated debate, Congress passed the greatest military reform in U.S. history. The National Security Act created the National Military Establishment, later called the Department of Defense, consisting of the departments of the Army, Navy, and Air Force, headed by a Secretary of Defense and a Joint Chiefs of Staff, JCS. Truman appointed the anti-Soviet hardliner James Forrestal as the first Secretary of Defense. Creating a new U.S. Air Force separate from the Army confirmed the importance of atomic warfare in future military planning. The act also created the National Security Council, a War Council, the National Security Resources Board, and the Central Intelligence Agency, all of which Marshall opposed because they gave the military too much influence over foreign policy and abridged the constitutional authority of the President and Secretary of State. Truman himself feared that the CIA could turn into a Gestapo or military dictatorship. The agency's clandestine nature troubled Acheson, who wrote, "I had the gravest forebodings about this organization and warned the president that as set up, neither he, the National Security Council, nor anyone else would be in a position to know what it was doing or to control it." Although the act specifically authorized the agency only to collect, analyze, and disseminate intelligence, it also empowered it to perform other functions and duties related to intelligence affecting the national security. The agency used that vague wording to conduct hundreds of covert operations, including 81 during Truman's second term alone. In late September 1947, Kennan urged Forrestal to establish a guerrilla warfare corps, a suggestion Forrestal heartily endorsed, although the JCS recommended against establishing a separate guerrilla warfare school and corps. In December, Truman approved secret annex NSC 4A, authorizing the CIA to conduct covert operations. He had dismantled the OSS's covert paramilitary operations capabilities in September 1945, but now he brought them back in force. In the summer of 1948, he approved NSC 10/2, which called for propaganda, economic warfare, preventive direct action including sabotage, anti-sabotage, demolition and evacuation measures, subversion against hostile states, including assistance to underground resistance movements, guerrillas, and refugee liberation groups, and support of indigenous anti-communist elements in threatened countries of the free world. These activities were to be done in a way that would always afford the U.S. government plausible deniability. In August 1948, Truman approved NSC 20, which authorized guerrilla operations in the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe. Even the seemingly benign Marshall Plan provided a cover for subversion. Half of the 10% of the money allocated for administrative costs was siphoned off to fund covert actions through the CIA's Office of Policy Coordination, whose director, Frank Wisner, would actually report to the Secretaries of Defense and State. Tim Weiner described it as a global money laundering scheme. Colonel R. Allen Griffin, who headed the Marshall Plan's Far East Division, confessed, "We'd look the other way and give them a little help, tell them to stick their hand in our pocket." Cannon, the architect of this effort, described it as the inauguration of organized political warfare. With the diverted funds, the CIA established a network of phony front organizations that recruited foreign agents as frontline warriors in the propaganda wars that ensued. Sometimes they went beyond propaganda, infiltrating unions and other existing organizations, and establishing underground groups. Forrestal and the Pentagon wanted the programs to go further, including guerrilla movements, underground armies, sabotage and assassination. Some of the diverted Marshall Aid money went to supporting a guerrilla army in Ukraine called Nightingale, which had been established by the Wehrmacht in the spring of 1941 with the help of Stephen Bandera, head of the Ukrainian National Organization's more radical wing, OUNB. The following year, Mykola Lebed founded the organization's terrorist arm, the Ukrainian